Good afternoon, Bay Area. Welcome to the Sights and Sounds Show with me, Janae Darden, where every week we tap into the Bay Area art scene and bring you rich conversations with artists. On today's show, a dramatic play about a girls' high school basketball team in the Deep South. Then an artist who creates beautiful work by cutting paper. And a literary festival is roaring back into downtown Oakland. Today's theme is seeing the extraordinary in the ordinary. That's all coming up. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Sights and Sounds Show with me, Janae Darden, on KALW 91.7 FM. The play Flex puts the basketball court on the theater stage. Ooh, I'm feeling this beat right now. Flex is about a high school girls basketball team in a dusty rural Arkansas town. Everybody's dancing while I'm reading the lead. The young ladies are playing hard to make high school history and win a state championship. Now, the play takes place around 1997 and 1998, which is why I'm feeling this music, too, because that's when I was in high school myself. And this was not long after the launch of the WNBA. The girls dream of playing pro, of course. Rivalry, sisterhood, reaching for your dreams, and sexuality are a few of the themes in the show. Flex is currently running at the San Francisco Playhouse. And the woman directing this all-female cast is Bay Area theater icon, and she was also bouncing, too. Miss Margo Hall. She was bouncing to the music, too. Hi, Miss Hall.
Yes, I was. Hello. Hello. Good to be here.
Yes, I'm so glad you're able to make it because I know you have a show tonight, so we appreciate that you made some time for us before the next show tonight. And I will have to say that before you even walk into the actual theater, you were getting in the mode for it's a basketball game. You guys had, it was so cute. You guys had a table like to sell snacks, like how I remember when I was in high school, like the little, you know, little snack concession table. The actors have trading cards and there's little basketballs everywhere. And then the music takes you back to the 90s. Like that was my high school soundtrack. So,
yes.
So you got, yes,
right?
Yes.
All of those iconic folks.
Yes.
TLC.
Yes. Yeah,
Aaliyah. Mm-hmm, yeah, such great
Missy
stuff.
Yeah, it was really, really. Yeah. I was having fun before y'all even came on stage. I was dancing.
That's how it's supposed to be. Yeah,
I said, let me dance a little bit. So, Margo, you are an award-winning actor, director, and playwright. You're the artistic director of the Lorraine Hansberry Theater, and you're directing this show, Flex, at the San Francisco Playhouse. How has it been directing a play about sports?
Oh, it's been incredible. I always say, look, I was a cheerleader.
Oh.
So I was not a basketball player. However, I was a diehard, and I still am, a diehard sports fan.
Nice.
So I hail from University of Michigan, so I'm so excited that we're the champions.
Yes.
It's been incredible working on this play. You know, I met Candace Jones, the playwright, in 2016, and we did an original workshop of this play in Berkeley Rep's ground floor when she first started writing this play.
Okay.
And so it's just been great to see the work that we did then and where it has come to. And for me, I finally got my hands on it as a director.
Wow, that's amazing because you saw it from the beginning. You saw it from the, and you've seen how it's evolved and grown. And you being a director, you know, has helped it grow too as well. Now, Candace Jones, she's from Arkansas, right?
Yes, she is.
Okay.
And she was a basketball player, high school basketball player.
Okay.
Yes.
So it definitely feels authentic. So I can see that voice or hear her voice in the play.
Yes.
So the choreography, the sports choreography is really awesome. And there's a scene where, you know, the Lady Train, that's the name of the team, they're playing another team, but there's no physical of the team there. So in your mind,
that's right.
They're playing against people that aren't there, you know, and so it's a basketball game. And in your mind, you're like putting the opposite team players on the court. So, yeah, again, the choreography is amazing. What were the challenges that come with directing a play that involves that type of choreography? And like, were some of the actors players too as well?
Yes. Yeah. It was a great process because we had a coach, a real coach named Emmanuel Blackwell, who happens to be my husband.
Oh. Oh.
He works for San Francisco Rec and Park, and he is a coach of many sports. And so brought in Manny, and he worked with the girls twice a week at outdoor courts in 80-degree weather and just did drills and worked them, because there's one Stara, who's the one of the main character of the play. She is a baller, right?
Okay.
So she came in with that. But the other girls have very limited experience. Some girls have no experience.
Okay.
And so he worked really hard to get them to a place where they understood the fundamentals and they understood what it takes to look like a basketball player. And then I come in with the actual choreography. So you have a combination of them actually running plays, and then you have the stylized work of creating the hyping up the idea of the drama of basketball. And so it was an amazing process, and they just took to it right away. If you look at them, you think they've been playing ball all their lives.
And they were making what happens, like, if there's a scene where they're supposed to make a basket and they don't, do they just kind of ad-lib? And
no, Kandra's covered everything. So if they miss, there's a whole nother scene that's written.
Whoa.
So they have to know both scenes. So if there's a miss at the end of the game, there's a whole nother scene and a whole another ending, which is fascinating.
Really?
Right? And yes. And so they do have to learn both possibilities.
Really?
And that's why it's so cool, because it's live. Anything can happen. They can hit or miss. So the audience gets it as it's happening.
So the ending so the ending tonight could be different than the ending I saw last night.
That's right. It sure can, if she misses that shot.
Ooh, or if she makes that shot. Oh,
yes.
My goodness. Oh, my goodness. Wow. That's so cool. Okay, because I was like, how do they do that? So the play, the magic of theater. Okay, so the play takes place in rural Arkansas. And again, the captain of the team is Stara. And she wants to be recruited to a top division college to play basketball so bad, like any other, you know, high school athlete. And she wants to get out of her rural, dusty town. And the dirt, you know, we have these characters with these girls, but the dirt is a character in this play. And to me, it represented a lot. It represented class. It represented secrets, doing people dirty, growth. You know, you grow from the dirt. Can you talk about the significance of the dirt? In this play,
the dirt and dust of Plano, Arkansas. Mm-hmm. And I feel like, as the coach says, this is the dust and dirt that made you, right? Because Stara, her parents made a dirt court for her in the backyard with a rim, with a chain link fence.
Mm-hmm.
And luckily, the way our set is designed, you get the dirt court and the gym. And so there's a lot of metaphoric ideas that go behind this idea of growing up in the dust and dirt, and how at the very end Stara says, I finally feel clean. Like I feel like I can leave this dirt and dust and take it to the next level, but I will never forget where I come from.
Yeah.
And I think that's very powerful, in that she has been in a situation where, from the very beginning of her life, her parents told her about the significance of the dirt and dust of Arkansas, and how that is will build her and build the legacy of their family.
Yeah.
So, at first, she doesn't understand that that's what she's made of. But at the very end, she realizes, that's why I am great, because of the legacy of the dirt and dust. And then you have Sydney, who's the girl from California, who comes and plays in Arkansas. And Star keeps comparing herself to Sydney, because she says Sydney is from California, the Sunshine State.
Right.
But Sydney doesn't know anything about playing in the dirt and the dust.
Right. And I love it. Sydney's like, I'm not from Hollywood or anything. I'm from Oakland.
You're thinking
of like Beverly Hills 90210 or something
right.
like that. You
know, she's like Mosswood Park.
Right, right. She's like, you know, I played on the courts in Mosswood Park.
Right.
If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with Margot Hall, director of the play Flex, and it's about a high school girls basketball team in rural Arkansas. Flex is currently running at the San Francisco Playhouse until May 2nd. And I'm also thinking, too, because this is a black cast, and I'm thinking about the dirt, and just when you think about, and I'm thinking about too, with Sydney, the other, the California,
Sydney,
you know, mm-hmm. and just I'm thinking about the Great Migration, right? How our grandparents, my grandparents, came from the dirt in Mississippi and
That's
in Texas,
right.
and we, you know,
right.
and brought that, and we carry that. That got us. That got
right.
that got us got me to college, right? And
right.
and got us to where you are, you know. So
yeah. And Sydney is from her family is from Arkansas.
Okay.
So when she moves back to be with her grandmother, who's become ill, she is just as much Arkansas as Oakland.
Right.
And so all of the ladies had to learn dialects, right?
Yeah.
They
yeah.
had to learn the Arkansas dialect. And Sydney also had to learn Oakland, even though she has spent a lot of time in the Bay Area. We wanted an authentic Oakland accent, but it also has that little bit of twang of Arkansas, right. as we all have from wherever we migrated
Absolutely.
From.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, in the rural South, especially today, we're talking about access to health care and poverty, you
yes.
know, access to health care, especially health care for women, reproductive health care. And in the play, one of the reasons why the school's team hasn't won a women's championship or girls' championship is because students on the team, they get pregnant. And so then they can't play anymore. And I was like, whoa, when that was in the the script, I was like really surprised by that.
And Kendra speaks on that because she said she remembered all the time somebody would end up pregnant, and it was a question of will they be able to play, will mm-hmm. they have the baby, and then come back. But she says it was never an issue where folks did anything about it, like they didn't have access to birth control. And even if they did, because of the Christian town,
right.
it was, you know, shunned if you tried to go to a Planned Parenthood or something like that. It was an expectation that you had to have the baby.
Right.
So there was not even an abortion clinic in their town. They would have to go to Greenville.
Right, right.
And so the idea of Sydney coming in, who's more progressive, and talking about these ideas of birth control
right.
and this young girl who feels like she's not ready to have a baby. And then it's exposed in the play, and I won't give it away.
Yeah, don't give it away.
Her
don't give
true
it away.
Reasons
yeah.
for not wanting to have this child. But it was a common thing that Candace talks about that used to happen all the time.
Yeah. And there's not even, like you said, there's not even just the shame of abortion, but there's also the shame of just even using, you know, protection.
Contraception.
You know? Yeah,
mm-hmm.
just even using
yes.
any kind of contraception. You know, and also, too, there's definitely messages in here about sisterhood,
yes.
working together to get to where you need to go, and, you know, individualism, too, as well. And I'm thinking of Star, who compares herself and to Sydney, and
right.
you know, that's what we do when we're young and older is comparing
yeah.
is comparing ourselves, especially definitely at that age. Yeah,
yeah. And you know, the idea of competition is so important in sports,
right?
And so even though they are very competitive in different ways, all of them, they still have to come together and form a team in order to be successful.
Right.
And I think that just like in any environment, you're going to have your individualism, but in the end, we have to come together and be the lady train. And this the play talks about that too.
Mm-hmm.
And also how you can use all the talents. The coach says you can make a play with the ball in your hand or not.
Yeah.
So it's a matter of teamwork. And one of the beautiful things about this play and the process that I have witnessed is how quickly these young ladies bond in real life.
Nice.
I mean, they have all become such good friends. They support each other. We also have understudies. We call them wonder studies, who would have to go on if something happened, and they attended all the rehearsals. And so they're there and they're all working together. And to see that amazing sisterhood amongst all these beautiful young Black folks, it just, you know, it just makes your heart just be open and wide. And I'm just so proud of them for the work that they're doing out there and all the love that they're showing on and off the stage.
Oh, that's wonderful. And I definitely felt that vibe because they were in sync and they were so together. We have about a minute. I want to talk about, you mentioned your husband was coaching the girls, and there's a coach.
Yes.
In the play, Coach Pace.
Yes.
And coaching is
yes.
more than, it's not just sports coaching. Can you talk about the significance of Coach Pace? Because, her role was very important.
Yes, I've often heard people who play sports and they say the coaches are like your parents. There are certain things you can go to your coach for, but you may not tell your parents. And so in this particular play, Coach is grappling with the idea of when she was also a player and a coach, they had the same issues around pregnancy.
Mm-hmm.
And so she has a rule that no girl can play if she's pregnant, but it comes from a personal circumstance that she went through.
Right.
And during the course of the play, she realizes that what she went through should not dictate what happens on the Lady Train team. So she also comes to a realization about how you handle the situation of dealing with pregnancy on the court.
Yeah.
And Halili Knox is a brilliant actress, and she's actually done the part 2 times before. And I've worked with Halili on several occasions, so I was very excited that she was willing to come back and play our coach. And so you got the strong coach, but she's also a mother figure. And she also understands the power that these young ladies hold. And if they can be dedicated to the craft, how they can make it out of Plano, Arkansas, and have a future, whether it's in basketball, or as in one of the girls, she's going to go to Xavier and get a degree in biology. And so you get all sides and facets of these young women in this rural town wanting to be a champion.
It's really a great play. And there's so many lessons in there, you know, for people who they have teenagers, bring them to the shows, for adults and teenagers too. But it'd be nice to bring a teenager so you can talk about some of the issues that come up. Miss Margo Hall, it's been a pleasure and an honor to have you on. Thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure being here. Thank you so much. And it was great to meet you last night. And I'm glad you enjoyed the show.
Yes, I did. You got to come back.
Yes, I will. When you come back.
No. Absolutely, absolutely. Margo Hall.
And come out to the Lorraine Hansberry Theater and see what we're doing down there.
Okay, we go talk because I love plays.
Okay.
Margo Hall is the director of the play Flex. Flex is running at the San Francisco Playhouse until May 2nd. We go bounce it out. Coming up, a San Francisco woman with the gift of cutting paper into beautiful works of art. Stay with us. You're listening to the Sights and Sounds show with me, Janae Darden, right here on KALW 91.7 FM. San Francisco-based artist Bianca Lehman creates art not necessarily by putting something on paper, but taking something from the paper. Her artistry is paper cutting. She takes black paper and makes cuts that create beautiful, dreamy landscapes and scenes and designs. And you can see her work and meet her this weekend at the annual Spring Open Studios. And that's at 1890 Bryant Street in the San Francisco Mission. And joining me here in studio is Bianca Lehman. Hello.
Hi.
Did I say your last name right?
Yes.
Okay, just want to make sure. I'm so happy you're here.
I'm so happy to be here.
Yeah, your work is so, I love dreamy, that kind of work. And when I looked at it, I was like, ooh, like it made me want to take a nap and just see it in my dreams when I was looking at your work. And it's so beautiful. And then watching you doing it was just, I watched a video of you and I said, wow, you had this little knife and you were just making something like with these little cuts. And it was just astounding. So I know I kind of simplify what goes into the art that you produce, but tell us, what is paper cutting?
Yeah, paper cutting is actually, it has a lot of really deep cultural roots, which is one of the reasons why I'm just really fascinated by it. That's okay. Not how I came to it, but exploring paper cutting, that is what I found. And so, you know, with papel picado, and it has different origins in many different countries. And so okay. There's the papel picado tradition, or a German Scherenschnitte tradition, and also a Chinese paper cutting tradition, mm-hmm. which is one of the oldest recorded forms of paper cutting. But the form that I do is usually with a black paper, like you mentioned, and I take a scalpel blade and cut images out.
Okay, wow. And you are a self-taught artist. So, again, I know you talked about the cultural background, but how did you become interested in this type of work? Like, did you see something and say, oh, I can do it? You picked up a knife and created something?
More or less. I think from a young age, I think I was always looking for a medium for self-expression. And so, you know, I tried writing poetry. I tried playing piano and guitar, and nothing really stuck. And then with paper cutting, I actually saw a book on contemporary paper cutting, okay. and was like, oh, maybe I will give that a try. And so I had a box cutter and a paper bag and tried my first paper cut with that. And there was something in it that really stuck with me and kind of grabbed me in a way, and was like, oh, I think there's something here. Like, it was the first time that I felt like whatever I was kind of imagining was physically manifested in a way.
Wow. Yeah. Wow, that's deep. And you grew up in an area, which makes sense when I look at your work, that you grew up in a farming community around lots of nature in Moore Park in California. And talk about how that influenced you as an artist. I imagine so, just seeing, because you do create a lot of naturescapes. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I remember lots of driving with my family as a kid and staring out the window and looking at both the hills and the farmland, and then also the ocean and things like that. And I think having the variety of landscapes to look at and just sort of daydream about has stayed with me sort mm-hmm. of just in my mind and in my imagination. And so when I'm doing my work and thinking about like these questions I'm thinking about or whatever and trying to answer them, or how do I represent that, oftentimes yeah. I am drawn to these imagined landscapes from my childhood.
Mm. What's your favorite thing to create when you do the paper cutting?
I kind of go through different phases. Okay. I went through a whole series for the last few years where it was kind of these versions of like floating islands or something like that, with a lot of like mountains and clouds. Oh. And I found that I'm being kind of called to the ocean again recently. Okay. So I think maybe the next series will kind of be exploring that again.
Okay. Yeah, it's so, like I said, your work is so beautiful. And you also, adding on to your professional background, which is interesting, are you still a medical writer? Are you still doing that?
I am, yes.
Okay. So you're a biology English major. You went to UC Davis. Mm-hmm. And I can see that in your work too, because you use a scalpel to cut the paper. So I'm like, there's a science part of you. And then your pieces tell a story. And you talked about, too, having interest in literature and poetry and stuff mm-hmm. as you were trying to find yourself as an artist. So how does all of that work for you, you know, when creating, having these gifts of literature and storytelling, and also to this skill with the scalpel?
Yeah, I think oftentimes a lot of my work is very tied to a strong personal narrative. And you know, I'm happy to talk about it with people at Open Studios and they ask questions. But honestly, like, there is a very personal meaning for me, but I don't necessarily want to put that onto the other person, because I feel like, you know, people can interpret pieces how they want to interpret that. And I don't want to take that away from them.
Yeah.
And as far as the scalpel goes, like, there is a meticulousness to using the scalpel blade, and also kind of with the editing work that I do. And I think that is sort of a little bit in my personality, for sure.
Okay.
But what I love about using the scalpel and doing all these paper cuts by hand is that you know, every line is not even, right? Like if you look at each leaf or each blade of grass, like it's all done by hand. And so you can, you know, there's mistakes in there, you know, there's places that I shouldn't have cut out or like, there's something about the mistakes being in the piece that is a metaphor for just sort of a general acceptance in life.
Yeah. I was going to say, and is the mistake the mistake? And, you know, real quick, if your headphones are uncomfortable, you can take it off.
Okay.
Yeah, you can take it off.
Okay, it's I'm going to do that.
It's totally cool. This is live. So, yeah, we want you comfortable. Cause everybody, I call the studio my living room. So I don't want people uncomfortable in my living room. So get comfortable. But yeah, it's okay. So like that was a live moment. That was not a moment of perfection. But is the mistake a mistake? When you look back at it, sometimes you're like, ooh, okay, I'm glad this had a little curve. I'm glad there's a little jagged cut because that gave us some oomph to the piece. Like, is the mistake a mistake sometimes?
Yeah, I mean, I guess we can reframe it instead of a mistake. It's just an unintended surprise.
Yeah. That is life.
Yeah.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with artist Bianca Levan. You can see her and her artwork along with many artists this weekend at the 1890 Bryant Street Spring Open Studios, and that will be happening in the San Francisco Mission. Okay, so I haven't been to that in a long time. The Spring Open. It's been maybe about a decade, I think. Oh. But I've been to those studios before. I don't know if maybe it wasn't the Spring Open, but I've been to those studios before, and I've walked around and talked to artists, not knowing one day I was going to be at KLW covering arts. But I've hung around there and met some really interesting and amazing people. There are over 100 artists who create at 1890 Bryant Street Studios, and you all are a community. So what does it feel like? What does that community, that collective, mean to you?
Yeah, I mean, I think so much of being an artist is creating work in solitude, right?
Yeah.
And part of the benefit or sort of the joy of being in a building like that is being around so many artists that are doing so many different things.
Mm-hmm.
And like you mentioned, there's, you know, painters and sculptors and jewelry makers and ceramicists. And, you know, during the open studios, people can come and talk to them and see what they're working on, see what they're thinking about. I think just being part of that community, I mean, we'll do happy hours. We support each other. And I think it's so important in this time to feel part of a community and feel supported and also give support.
And I got that vibe when I was there really a long time ago. So when you sit down to do these pieces, you know, and it's like, what's the process? What does it look like? What is when Bianca has her paper and her scalpel? What is that like? How long does it take? I mean, I know for different sizes it takes different lengths, but what is it like for you when you're in the zone creating?
Yeah, I mean, oftentimes, you know, a piece will originate from an inspiration, and that inspiration could be something that I am trying to think through or process for myself, or even just the way, like, the light hits a building or a tree at a certain time of day, and being like, oh, can I replicate that or try to do my version of that in black paper and white space, you know, like, is that possible? And so part of it is, you know, doing a drawing first and kind of having an idea of what I want it to look like. And sometimes that's just a little more practical, like with composition or scale or like how big should it be and, you know, things like that. And then my first step is usually to draw it out all by hand. Okay. And so I'm not using, you know, digital tools or anything like that. So if I want to move a tree over, I erase the whole thing and redraw it. And so it does take quite a lot of time. And so after the drawing process, then I'll go in with the scalpel blade and cut the paper out.
Okay. Yeah. And so you'll draw the tree and then you'll take the scalpel and cut out that drawing.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. And so how long, here I'm sitting in front of a 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper. Like how long would that take for you to, your eyes are widening too. Like,
I know. You know, I work on multiple pieces at a time and sort of in bits and spurts, but you know, I do make them detailed and almost every time I'm like, I'm going to make this one less detailed, but inevitably it just is what happens. But I think from the drawing process to the finish, I mean, it could take anywhere from like 40 to 50 hours or something.
Wow. So for people that are going to come out and meet you and look at your work, I just want folks to know how much energy you put in, emotion and time you put into that, to like for somebody to take a piece home or buy a piece from you, and it's, you put like 50 hours into it. That's a lot.
Yeah.
but I can see, like I said again, your work is really, really beautiful. How do you see yourself evolving as an artist?
Oh my gosh, that's a great question. You know, I think one of the joys about being an artist is like kind of not knowing where it'll go and being driven by curiosity, mm-hmm. or the things that, you know, that one gravitates to. And, you know, I have been doing paper cutting for about 14 years now. And every now and again, I'm like, you know, when I do a piece, I'm like, maybe this is the last one. Like, I don't know. But like, who knows? But, you know, I've currently been exploring a little bit with charcoal drawing and pastel. And I've also, in the past few years, also done some curation and art curation for shows. And so, I'm pretty open to it.
So you like, I can work behind the scenes,
yeah.
or I can just like work out there. Anything people, we got like about a minute left. Anything people can expect when they come to the studio? Because again, it can be a little overwhelming because it's all, like I said, it's 100 artists there. I don't know if they'll all be selling things, but any advice for people who are walking around and.
Yeah, I mean, my first exposure to the San Francisco art community was through an open studios, and that actually got me on this path for creativity and being an artist. I would say, you know, just talk to the artists and ask them questions if you're interested. I think, you know, they want to share about their process, about what they're working on, because, like I said, a lot of the work is often made in silo and in solitude. And so the sharing and the talking is part of why we do this, right? And then I'll also say that during that weekend, this weekend during Open Studios, there's also Project Arto opening up, and then Art Explosion. So in a few block radius, there's even more studios you can visit.
And what was the first one you said? Project
Arto.
Project Arto. And where can people specifically find you in 1890 in the building? Because this is a big building.
I'll be on the second floor in Studio 209.
Okay. All right. So second floor, Studio 209. You all make sure you go say hi to Bianca and check out her beautiful work. Bianca, I'm so happy you came and I got to talk to you. And I love your work. And please don't stop making those beautiful images. I know you said this might be the last time, but don't do it. Well, unless the muse tells you, but... yeah, keep going.
Thank you so much.
I've been chatting with Bianca Levin. You can see her and her artwork, along with many, many artists, this weekend at the 1890 Bryant Street Spring Open Studios. And that will be happening in the San Francisco Mission. And next up, the beast is back and it's hungry for good rhymes and prose. I'm talking about the Oakland literary event, Beast Crawl. Rawr. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Sights and Sounds Show with me, Janae Darden, on KALW 91.7 FM. I don't know about y'all, but I'm feeling this music. Producer Porfiria Rango on the ones and twos. All right, April is National Poetry Month, and we in the Bay Area are so, so fortunate to live in a place with so many poetry readings and talented writers. And one event you don't want to miss is Beast Crawl. The festival began in downtown Oakland in 2012, and this year you'll have two weekends to indulge in poetry by some of the best poets in the Bay Area and beyond, and it is free. But of course, donations are always welcome. And joining me to tell us what we can expect is Beast Crawl co-founder Paul Corman Roberts and fellow poet Keith Gaberie. And I hope I said his name right. Welcome, gentlemen.
Yes. Hi. Hi, welcome.
Hey, Paul.
Hi.
Hi, Janae.
Hello. Okay, so good to see you guys. And Keith, and hello. Okay.
Hello.
Yes, and Keith is also a preschool teacher, which I've been hyping that up because I just think that's great.
Yeah.
Yes.
Thank you.
That is so important. Okay, Paul, the festival is 14 years. Is that right?
Yeah, this is the four. This will be the 14th year, And I think there's been only one year when it didn't actually run. There was actually one quiet year. I believe that was 2019.
Yes.
2019. And even during the quarantine, we had some version of ourselves happening either as a marathon or an online festival.
Right, it was
festival.
Online. I remember I was on
right.
That.
Yeah. So the fact that we have reinvented the format of the festival, we're sort of reinventing the festival this year and leaning into our poetry roots is kind of, it's just kind of on brand for us because we've never had, you know, one year look exactly like the last year.
Yeah, no, and I was like, Paul, you've been doing this for 14 years. I know it's a lot of work. You and I have talked about it. You're crazy, Paul. What brings you back to do this?
You know, some things are bigger than just a person, right?
Right. Yeah. It's community.
Yeah.
It's definitely about community.
That's what it's meant to be. That it's, you know, somebody once told me that the very first Beast Crawl we ever had in 2012, and I remember just sitting outside the bar on Telegraph Street at the after party, just exhausted, right? Just exhausted, mm-hmm. sitting on the sidewalk, leaning up against the wall. My buddy's right there next to me. He says, what you've done is you've taken all these hot burning particles and you've compressed them into this tiny little space where they're forced to interact with each other for a short amount of time. And it creates a lot of heat and a lot of friction. And when you have a lot of heat and friction, new structures form and build up out of that. I'm like, yeah, that's a good metaphor. That's what we're trying to do. And to this day, that's still what we're trying to do.
And Paul, remind people, where does the name Beast Crawl come from?
You know, because amongst the original founders, they just loved and felt that there needed to be a festival that represented the translation of East Bay in Pig Latin, right? And of course, to say beast, when you say beast in Pig Latin, it comes out East Bay. And people had been using that joke in the East Bay. And the East Bay was called the Beast by punkers and rappers for years and years anyway. And it was Andrew Thomas and Youssef Alawi, who both decided that you have to have a festival in the East Bay that's called the Beast, and it might as well be ours. And I will tell you, Keith was there. Keith knows this. He was at this meeting where we debated changing the name of the festival because we're getting very aggressive about applying for grants and things like that. Mm-hmm. And one of the things you have to do when you're applying for grants is be able, it helps if your name is catchy and it tells the funders what it does. And we're always like, nobody knows what the Beast Crawl is. Nobody knows what that is. And we talked about changing it for that reason. And we decided against it. We decided to stick to form, stick to the tradition that just doesn't make any sense.
Okay. And Keith, so we're talking about beasts. And we're talking about using language. So you're a preschool teacher, because I'm sure if Paul was in a classroom, you'd be like, watch your mouth. But I read in your bio that you compare yourself to a dragon. Okay, so what's with the dragon? A friendly dragon. That's the sense I got. Since we're talking about beasts, what is it about the dragon that appeals to you?
Well, the magical aspect of being a dragon and the imagination. And I feel that as a preschool teacher and a poet, I can use my imagination and magic in different ways, right? Whether it's if I'm talking with a child or writing or organizing, you know, there's magic in all those aspects.
Yeah. And you've been part of Beast Crawl since the beginning. As an organizer?
No, well, Paul has been, you know, obviously one of the co-founders. I've been involved with Beast Crawl. Like, I've gone to, like, different readings and participated in readings over the years. But this is the first time that I've been, like, a co-organizer, like, for this festival. So I wanted to, make more of an impact in that way.
Paul is touching his heart because he appreciates the work that you put into it. And I know, Paul, I was joking, you guys like, Paul, you're crazy for doing this, because I know it's a lot of work. But Paul, I know how much this means to you, and I know just the fact, you know, we have this in the Bay Area, and of course, you know, I'm always biased because it's in Oakland, and it is it the longest running literary festival in Oakland? Or one of these?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Yeah, it's Oakland's longest continuous literary festival. There has been no other that has run as long. NPS tried, National Poetry Slam tried to make it a permanent home. That wasn't able to work. The Oakland Book Festival tried. The East Bay Poetry Summit tried. Mm-hmm. You know, they all had a couple of good years runs. We all had the good years runs, but the Beast is the one that kept coming back year after year. And I'm getting to the point where I think it needs to be freshened up. I'm the last of the OGs. Okay. I'm the last of the original founders. I'm looking for a graceful exit, even for myself, to be perfectly transparent about it. And I was very transparent about that with the other organizers who were involved this year. The thing is, we do have other organizers involved this year, which was more than we had last year. Mm-hmm. And they're enthusiastic and they share my belief that Oakland needs to have a long-term annual literary festival, given the town's literary heritage. Yeah. Given the fact you look at the writers from Oakland, the writers who live in Oakland, and why is it so difficult to make this happen in Oakland? When other townships sort of get a little more support and a little more backing, I get it with Oakland. It's tough. It's a tough town. But it's a town that loves good writing, and good writing comes from it, and good writing has saved a lot of the people in the town. And yeah. I've seen it with my own eyes. I will advocate for it till my dying day.
Yeah, and I'm thinking, I mean, the town produced Tommy Orange, the town, you know, produced Ryan Coogler. I mean, these are just a few great writers that have come out of
just an intense writers. Jack London, Joaquin Miller. Yeah. You know, going back, you know, the California Writers Club will go track the history of Oakland for you very nicely, mm-hmm. actually, and how many amazing writers have been here. And because writers don't make a ton of money, because in order to be a writer, you have to learn to live a little bit below, you know, a lot of us live in the East Bay, you know, and whenever the other local literary festivals want to honor Oakland writers, they have to go to another town to do it. We need our own party, you know?
Yeah, yeah. If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Beast Crawl co-founder Paul Corman Roberts and poet Keith. Oops, I misspelled your name. Keith, what's your last name for me? Say it for me again.
Gabri,
thank you.
Yeah.
My bad. This is live radio. I'm speaking with Beast Crawl co-founder Paul Corman Roberts and poet Keith Gabri. They're both part of the organizing team behind the literary festival Beast Crawl. And you can see and hear poetry at various venues throughout downtown Oakland over two weekends. And this weekend, April 10th to the 12th and April 18th to the 19th. Okay, so Paul, what can we expect? Because you said every year is different. So, yes. Hmm.
This is the most different we've ever been. In the past, it was always on one night. It was 30 to 40 pop-up readings all over downtown Oakland in one single night. Now, having it stretched out over two weekends, we are not having simultaneous events. This way, we can focus on one event at a time and maximizing the audience one event at a time. We're taking our model a little bit more from perhaps the Berkeley Poetry Festival, but also the Petaluma Poetry Walk. And that's what I noticed when I went to the Petaluma Poetry Rock, is they kept to that aesthetic that I love, where all of the venues where the readings are happening are all within walking distance of each other. Don't even get in your car and drive to the next one or drive to there's no. But when you're walking from place to place and you're learning an area and you're learning a town and you're learning the arts of that town, you know, you engage better. You engage better with people and you engage better with the community when you're out there in your boots on foot. I really stand by that aesthetic. And I think that's the really wonderful thing that Lit Crawl showed us, mm-hmm. you know, back in the day, why we took a lot of inspiration from Lit Crawl. And it's harder when your venues get further apart. It creates a dissonance that you don't want in the dynamic, in the chemistry of the dynamic. You want the friction, you want the heat, you want these diverse personalities with different disciplines, different arts, and different mediums coming together, interacting with each other, and coming up with new ideas. Bring them together. Don't drive them apart. And that's, we're hanging on to that aesthetic. But we are going to focus one event at a time. I think over the long run, this will help us be more inclusive as mm-hmm. well. And to sort of build up the juice of the festival.
So I love it. So instead of having two readings at 3 o'clock, there's one reading at 3 o'clock, yeah. right? And then another one at 4.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, the readings are a little bit longer. Instead of an hour, they're an hour and a half. They're 90 minutes. So, some of these days we're starting at noon, sometimes at 2, but you give it a good hour and a half. There's still a half hour in between events. You still have 30 minutes to walk to that next venue. You got plenty of time to grab something to eat and drink at, you know, in Oakland. And support some of the local businesses, because we also want to support the side business, the independent mom and pop businesses. And that is the hardest thing in Oakland right now. It kills me to walk through the town and see all the shuttered storefronts. Yeah, wonder we're having such a hard time. No wonder it's hard to get people together. There's just that whole strip along Grand Street, we're off of Grand and Broadway. The running store is gone. And the last thing standing there, I think, is the pizza joint, the barbecue joint, and Zanzi. And I think that's about it. And that's not, we got Farley. Farley's is still going too. I was hanging some flyers in Farley's earlier today.
Yes. I was sending just well wishes and good thoughts out to the co-owner of Farley's who was.
Yeah, no, it was really rough walking in there actually. But we don't have them on the itinerary this year, but we do want to give them support and love.
Yeah, definitely shout out to Farley's, and yeah, my heart goes out to them because it's really I'm very concerned about that woman that is missing. And they definitely too, I've gone to so many poetry readings there too as well. So they've been supporting.
Yeah, no, that's the beast crawl of old, where we were basically getting the fire marshal mad at us because we had too many people in those spaces.
Yeah.
And and while it's a good feeling for the writers to experience that, it's not particularly safe either. So we've addressed that issue too. That's a major accessibility issue. And that's one of the things that we're really taking on in our new leadership. Our new leadership includes, Reggie Edmonds and Tino Vasquez Edmonds from Rich Oak. We've got J.R. Rice involved in the organizing now, and some other folks who've come in and just helped out a great. And accessibility is really important to this crew. And I really believe that the youth will serve by being served. Okay. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. That'd be nice for, more youth to get involved so we can continue the legacy. We have about 3.5 minutes. Who wants to read a poem? How about Keith?
Oh, yeah, sure.
You want to do a poem? Okay.
Yeah.
Go for it.
Okay, this is Concrete and Petroleum Through the Centuries. The 21st century is being built on 20th century concrete. Concrete cracks like my sandy-colored face under a global warming sun. I transverse down Madison Street, carrying a plastic bag made from petroleum, in my rubber shoes made from petroleum, as I wear my plastic glasses made from petroleum. All this petroleum gives global warming an open invitation into our heliocentric home. In the 22nd century, I bet petroleum will seep into human bloodstreams. In 2026, I step off Madison into Oakland History Center. I'm ready to absorb the 20th century history I failed to learn in school.
Mm. Wow. Thank you for that. Wow. Paul, you wanna? We have 2 more minutes. Thank you so much for that, Keith.
Oh, sure, yeah. I wrote this poem this week. This will be new.
Okay, new stuff.
new stuff. Can't say the other thing.
Right.
My dad retired last week at the age of 81. He was a cashier at a recycling plant in Arcata. A thin veil of plexiglass separating him and $3,000 to $5,000 in live cash from Humboldt County street urchins. He took a concealed 25 into work every day. I'm glad he isn't doing that anymore. He would tell me that sooner or later, roulette pays off one way or another, the dying being one of the ways that happens. I haven't mentioned him that this also happens to be my life's spiritual and artistic model. Hopefully you get to look luck in the eyes at the same time it's looking into yours as the carousel goes round. But in the meantime, I'm leaving all you suckers in the poetry racket behind to become a Shakespearean character actor in an upscale suburb. Therefore, I must take leave now to cultivate a smoking habit. Come drop a flower by my tombstone sometime. I'll bring cards and deal you in while you keep the dice warm.
Ooh, And I see both of you kind of had some environmental themes going on in there too, and similar endings. So the mood. So there you got, you know, these
and
are
somewhere or another. We always want to get back to the nature, right?
Got to. That's a poet. So you all listening, that's just a small, just a small sample of what to expect. And you two, as far as with Beast Crawl, there's going to be a special Beast Crawl organizers performance. That's going to be this Friday evening at North Lake. So if you all want to catch Keith and Paul, they're going to be at North Lake, which is on Broadway.
Yeah, North Point, the North Lake space there, that 2270 Broadway space, which is just magical. And I'm so happy they have it. And there's so much good public stuff going on. And they've welcomed us in. And it's just, we're excited to kick off the festival in that space. The only thing I've heard is that there's a real good chance it's going to be raining that night. So we might. We have a backup plan, which is I think we're going to take it over to Nomadic Press just down the block if that happens.
Okay, so follow them because we got to go.
Hopefully we stay dry.
Okay, so we got to go, Paul. But yeah, so backup plan, Nomadic Press Bookshop, which I haven't gone to yet. Paul,
yes.
Always a pleasure. Keith, so nice to meet you. Thank you both for your
Thank
time.
You.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, KALW. I appreciate you so much.
And I will see y'all at the Beast Crawl. Paul Corman Roberts is the co-founder of Beast Crawl, and poet Keith Gabory is one of the organizers. And that's all the time we have for the Sights and Sounds show with Janae Darden. Thank you to our show producer, Porfirio Rangel, our board operator, Damian Miner, and thank you, the listener, for tuning in. We'll have another great show for you right here next Wednesday at 4 p.m. Until then, be good to yourselves and each other.